Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. The Federal Trade Commission announced that companies promising over the phone to reduce your credit card or other debt can't charge you a fee until they do their job. The rule affects for-profit businesses and will kick in October 27th. FTC Chairman John Leibowitz says that the new regulation aims to prevent companies from taking money from consumers and never fulfilling a promise to reduce customers' debt by half or more. Too many of these companies pick the last dollar out of customers' pockets, and far from leaving them better off, push them deeper into debt, even bankruptcy, Leibowitz said in a prepared statement. And from Bloomberg.com, Wells Fargo's stump sees new costs for customers. Wells Fargo and Company Chief Executive Officer John Stumpf said customers, not just the bank, will bear the financial burden for U.S. regulations that cover services ranging from home loans to credit cards. I can't guarantee that we won't pass some of these costs on, Stumpf, 56, said in an interview at his San Francisco office. We'll try to tighten our belt and absorb some of the costs of compliance, but some costs may change and customers might pay for their financial services in new ways. Stumpf's comments add to evidence that new rules mean new expenses for consumers as banks make up for lost revenue and increased costs. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company CEO Jamie Dimon said the legislation may translate into higher fees and credit card rates, and Bank of America Corp's Brian Monahan told shareholders a day later he's looking for ways to soften the impact on annual revenue, which the lender said could be $2.3 billion. Wells Fargo, with the biggest U.S. branch network, is already passing on costs by charging for checking accounts and raising interest rates on credit cards and loans, said Richard Bove, a banking analyst at Rochdale Securities, LLC. The bank ended free checking last month by adding a $5 monthly fee for customers who don't meet certain conditions. This bank does not intend to sit there and get nailed, said Bove, who recently upgraded Wells Fargo shares to a buy. Wells Fargo has moved well ahead of the crowd, and everyone will follow. President Barack Obama signed into law a 2,300-page overhaul of financial regulation that gives the government authority to unwind failing financial firms, imposes new rules on derivative markets, and creates a consumer protection agency to monitor loans and services. Stumpf said it's too early to judge the cost for Wells Fargo, in part because the bank is looking for ways to offset expenses and lost revenue. Even with the bill's shortcomings, Congress got many parts of it right, Stumpf said in the July 22nd interview. The creation of a systemic risk regulator will prevent another crisis from being sparked by the collapse of large financial firms, he said. The Financial Stability Oversight Council, a super regulator, will monitor Wall Street's largest firms and other market participants to spot emerging systemic risks. Too big to fail has been dealt with, said Stumpf, whose bank holds $1.2 trillion of assets. Regulators needed a way to understand risk at the top of the house and opine on that risk. They did it in a way that makes a lot of sense. Some of the new consumer protections, however, don't go far enough because they contain too many exemptions, Stumpf said. Auto dealers and banks with less than $10 billion in assets may be exempt from some curbs. Consistent consumer protection rules are good for Americans, and it's good for us as providers because we know the playing field is level, Stumpf said. Does it become less level because the Consumer Protection Agency has direct involvement with certain companies and not others and will rely on other regulators to do it? I don't know. That's where the trickiness comes up. Wells Fargo, which ranks fourth by assets and third by deposits among U.S. banks, has dropped 20% since the middle of 2007 when credit markets began to falter, compared with 17% through last week for New York-based J.P. Morgan and 71% for Bank of America, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. New York Citigroup, Inc. slid 92%. Wells Fargo rose 18 cents to 28.25 in the New York Stock Exchange composite trading. The biggest stakeholder is Berkshire Hathaway, Inc., the insurance and holding company controlled by billionaire Warren Buffett. Stumpf singled out new curbs on debit interchange fees for criticism. Under the so-called Durbin Amendment, the Federal Reserve gets authority to limit interchange or swipe fees that merchants pay for each debit card transaction. The measure pushed by Senator Richard Durbin lets retailers refuse credit cards for purchases of less than $10 and offer discounts based on the form of payment. That is a dispute between banks and merchants, and it somehow found its way into regulatory reform, Stumpf said. He told analysts, "I don't see how debit card fees between banks and merchants had anything to do with what happened in the last couple of years." Stumpf isn't the only financial leader voicing displeasure. Card industry executives say the legislation amounts to price controls, said American Express Company Vice Chairman Ed Gilligan, before the language was finalized, that the Durbin Amendment provides no benefit to consumers. The largest payment networks, Visa Inc. and MasterCard Inc., also opposed the amendment. New rules on derivatives will mandate that swaps between banks and major users like hedge funds and asset managers be backed by clearinghouses. Stumpf said moving those trades to clearinghouses would help show the true size of the derivatives market, but doesn't address what happens when a borrower doesn't pay or a member of the clearinghouse collapses, he said. Somebody's got to take the credit risk, Stumpf said. His concern was echoed by Joel Teltner, a partner with the law firm of Jones Day in New York, who spoke in an interview. Maybe we are creating new entities that are too big to fail and setting up a scenario in the future where we're going to be arguing and anguishing about bailing out the clearinghouses, Teltner said. So that was from an article by Bloomberg.net, Dakin Campbell, the writer. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And the next thing I'd like to talk about is an article from Jessica Silver Greenberg from the Bloomberg News, because there are many new credit card tricks that are coming up months after the historic legislation which banned certain billing practices. Card issuers have now dreamed up new ones designed to trip up consumers. One of the hot issues is who's going to be the head of the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, and we have been voting for Elizabeth Warren. But as the article points out, whomever gets chosen by President Barack Obama, they could find it difficult to keep ahead of the credit card industry. The Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act of 2009, which is also known as the CARD Act, was intended to reshape consumer finance, basically. Among other things, it forces card issuers to give customers more notice about interest rate increases and restricts certain controversial billing practices, such as inactivity fees. The CARD Act forces issuers to give customers more notice. Yet, some of the biggest card issuers in the U.S., including Citigroup Inc., JPMorgan Chase & Company, and Discover Financial Services, are already rolling out a number of fees designed to actually recapture some of their lost income, in part by skirting the new rules. Some banks may even be violating the law outright, say consumer advocates at least. Card companies are figuring out how to replace old fees with new ones, says Victor Stango, an associate economist with the Federal Reserve Board of Chicago and a professor at the University of California, who has been analyzing how the CARD Act will affect consumer banking. It's a race between regulators writing ever more complex laws and credit card companies setting up ever more complex fees, he said. The banks have a big gap to fill. The CARD Act is expected to wipe out about $390 million a year in fee revenue, according to David Robertson, the publisher of industry newsletter Nielsen Report. During its second quarter earnings, Bank of America Corp. Chief Financial Officer Charles Noski warned that the CARD Act and other regulatory changes would prompt the bank, the nation's largest in assets, to write off up to $10 billion in the third quarter. If you have every major issuer saying that we are losing our shirt, then that speaks volumes, Mr. Robertson says. Proportionately, these fees should be understood as almost inconsequential compared to the losses. So the banks are getting aggressive. According to a report from Pew Charitable Trusts, a nonpartisan research group, the industry's median annual fee on bank credit cards jumped 18% to $59 between July 2009 and March 2010. At credit unions, annual fees soared 67% to $25. During the same period, the median cash advance and balance transfer fees jumped by 33%. Well, all of these increases are perfectly legal, of course. Banks and other issuers would have a difficult time extending credit to consumers, even at high interest rates, if they couldn't augment those revenues with fee income, according to the banking industry. We're coming out of a deep recession that issuers are still working through, says Peter Garuccio, a spokesman for the American Bankers Association. But on the other hand, some banks may be going too far. In a recent letter to the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates many of the biggest U.S. banks, a coalition of consumer groups, including the National Consumer Law Center, the Consumer Federation of America, and Consumer Action, flagged several potential violations of the Credit Card Act. Other banks are ramping up their marketing of so-called professional cards. These are like corporate cards, but can carry the same terms as consumer cards and aren't covered under the new law. In the first quarter of this year, issuers sent out 47 million professional card offers to U.S. households, up from 13.2 million in the corresponding period last year, according to research firm Synovate. This can be a very easy way around the CARD Act, says Josh Frank, a senior researcher at the Center for Responsible Lending, a consumer group. The upshot? Borrowers must be more vigilant than ever, even before they make their first charge on the new card. Alan Condon of Woodstock, Georgia, says he carefully reviews his card statements each month and even read the CARD Act, all 33 pages, after it was passed in May 2009. Alan is a self-employed computer programmer and is one of many who was hit with a fee that was made illegal by the CARD Act. Among other things, the CARD Act stipulates that late payment fees shouldn't be triggered on a Sunday or holiday when there is no mail delivery. The rule is clearly meant to offer cardholders some semblance of relief so that they don't get saddled with late fees for making a reasonable payment on the next business day, says Chi-Chi Wu, a consumer credit lawyer at the National Consumer Law Center. Mr. Condon says he was shocked when he opened his credit card statement dated June 18th and saw that Discover had charged him $39 for a late fee and had upped his interest rate on future purchases from 17% to 24.99%. He says the company considered him late because he paid on June 14th instead of June 13th, a Sunday. "I just got mad," says 56-year-old computer software developer, who says he had never been late before on any Discover payment. "We were in compliance with the CARD Act," says Discover spokesman Matthew Towson. "The law states that if a creditor does not receive or accept payment on weekdays or holidays, then the date is extended, but we accept payments 7 days a week." Nevertheless, Discover reviewed Mr. Condon's account at the Wall Street Journal's request and decided to waive the late fee and reduce Mr. Condon's interest rate to its earlier level. The CARD Act also stipulates that issuers can't jack up rates on existing balances unless a cardholder is at least 60 days late. But there is a creative maneuver around that, the so-called rebate card. Citibank rolled out rebate card offers to some of its customers last fall, offering to refund up to 70% of the finance charges when customers pay on time. The problem? Rebate offers aren't governed by the CARD Act, and an issuer can revoke them suddenly and hit cardholders with high charges. The net result is the same as raising rates, and because it is perfectly legal, customers have little recourse. Rebates on finance payments may seem like a good deal, but you could end up with a very high interest rate suddenly, says Mr. Frank of the Center for Responsible Lending. The rebate offer is clear, transparent, and we believe fully within the spirit of the CARD Act, says Citigroup spokesman Samuel Wang. Shortening the billing cycle is another new tactic some banks may be using. The CARD Act requires companies to provide a window of at least 21 days from when a statement is mailed and when payment is due. Yet, the National Consumer Law Center and Consumer Action say they have received complaints from borrowers who allege that their billing cycles have been shortened to fewer than 21 days. Since the passage of the Act, we've heard from numerous borrowers alleging that they are shortchanged on billing cycle time, says Joe Rideout, a consumer services manager at Consumer Action. So this was by Josh D. Weiss for the Wall Street Journal. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's move on to the two-income trap, which we have been studying for quite a while now, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tiagi, whose thoughts, ideas, and examples are used in this program and are directly from or based on their work, theories, and books. And I highly recommend two of their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. And as always, you can visit the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt and listen to all of the shows which have been produced to try to help you to understand debt, where it comes from, how to deal with it, how to get rid of it, and how to prevent it. So we're winding down the whole study of the two-income trap, and we're in the chapter which Professor Warren calls the financial fire drill. How should a family protect itself from the two-income trap, meaning essentially that both parents are working and the whole economy has become dependent upon two incomes coming in, and then of course something happening where then in periods of time only one income is coming in due to a divorce, a job loss, child being born, etc. So Professor Warren and Amelia state that the deck is stacked against today's parents who struggle to solve financial problems on their own. A generation of bidding wars has launched an army of competing buyers against any family that tries to cut back on its spending. And the buying wars are to try to get the best houses in the neighborhoods with the best schools, which, of course, inflates the price of the houses. Then there's been a generation of layoffs, divorces, and spiraling medical costs, and these have hit pretty much everyone. Professor Warren, in this book, offered suggestions for collective action, recommendations for Congress and state legislatures, political action groups, and faith-based organizations, school districts, and community institutions. She believes that the collective action is really the most effective remedy, and it's essential for establishing economic security for middle-class parents. She does admit, however, that such changes, which are big, take time. And in the meantime, families need to safeguard themselves right here, right now. So her question is, what should a family do? Well, for starters, everyone raising a family needs to get a good book on financial planning. But she warns that that means to be careful. The basic premise of most of these books can be misleading and even dangerous. They show how to draw up a budget or choose a mutual fund, but in most cases, their advice is aimed only at those lucky families for whom work is steady, everyone is healthy, and there are no emergencies, which isn't really most families anymore. Disaster, job loss, premature birth, a divorce is the defining theme of the financial lives of millions of families, but it doesn't appear in most financial advice books or in most families' financial plans. In response to that, I highly, highly recommend her book, All You're Worth, which is really nuts and bolts, middle-class budgeting and thinking, and it is actually the source for a major portion of my shows some while ago, and you can get all of that information by coming to the archives and listening to those shows, or just going to the library and getting the book, All You're Worth. She points out with an analogy that any firefighter will explain that the time to prepare for an emergency is before the house catches on fire. Install smoke detectors, get oily rags out of the garage, run through a practice fire drill, and do it now when there is no smoke in the air. So the same advice does apply to financial problems. Protect yourself before they happen. So she uses the phrase a financial fire drill. Clever parents should run them. Now, a financial fire drill has three basic questions. Can your family survive without one income? That's the point. She first investigates. Again, remember, we're talking about a two-income trap. Mother, father, domestic relationship, both people working. And money coming in to support a family. And built upon both incomes. Well, if your family is like the average two-income family, then you face a 1 in 16 chance that in any given year, at least one of you will lose your job. That's 1 in 16 chance of losing a job. If you are a single parent, you actually face smaller odds of a layoff because there is only one person at work. But the consequence of a job loss can be even worse if that sole income disappears. That's obvious. But in either case, the litmus test is the same. Can you survive for 6 months without one of the incomes that you currently rely on? That's the important point. And she goes into this point in great detail in her book, All You're Worth, and shows you how to set this up. If you are a married couple with only one earner, then the question is easier. Could the stay-at-home parent enter the job market if something happened to the primary breadwinner? Now, regardless of your group, if the answer is no, then it's time for some disaster planning. So that's the first point. Can you and your family survive without one income for 6 months? The second question is, can you downshift the fixed expenses? Fixed expenses. If you're having trouble meeting your bills and making ends meet, the average financial planning book advises you to pass up those impulse purchases or another dinner out so that you can save more and get out of debt. Sounds very simple. But the experts, who these people are, actually have it exactly wrong. If you eliminate all the treats now while times are good, then where will you cut back when a real financial crisis appears? You need to take another look at your budget. If you are feeling squeezed during ordinary times, it is likely that you have a much bigger problem than an occasional dinner at the local restaurant. You have a problem with your fixed costs. It's the time then to take a hard look at the necessities, not the frills, the wants. If you're having a difficult time making ends meet, think about lowering your fixed expenses. Can you manage a few more years without a new car? Can you sign up for the lower cost HMO, even if that means shifting the kids to a different pediatrician? Would your toddler be all right in a less expensive preschool? And toughest of all, should you move to a cheaper house, one you can manage on a smaller mortgage? Of course, these are obviously difficult decisions for any family, but it's better to confront them now when you have time and flexibility to make reasonable choices rather than later when the creditors are calling and your back is to the wall. Within these words is a corollary, a piece of advice to the family shopping for a home. And we've talked about this a lot in the past. Do not stretch yourself to buy a house you can't afford. And we've seen this happening in the last 3 or 4 years in the foreclosure crisis, where in fact people did do that. Unfortunately, a lot of them were forced to do it by the machinations and deceptions and hard sell tactics of the brokers and the credit industry. But get your head screwed on straight right now if you're looking for a house. If the only way you can meet the mortgage payments for your dream house is to tighten your belt and commit both incomes, do not do it. The fact that you have been approved for a mortgage, as you can see, is no guarantee that you can actually afford it. And frankly, it may mean that you can't afford it unless it's a local bank and everybody sits down face to face with you and goes over all of your numbers in great excruciating detail. As painful as it may be, it is wiser to rent for a few more years or to buy a smaller home. The oversized mortgage will leave you with no room for error, no cash for even minor emergencies, let alone a real disaster. But Professor Warren points out something curious. She says there is a silver lining to all this abstemious advice. It is okay to splurge on extras. Never mind the dour looks from the overconsumption camp, which we have talked about in the past. So long as you are staying out of debt and putting something away in savings, you should feel free to buy the kids a new pair of shoes or treat yourself to a night on the town. If the tough times come, you can drop those expenditures in a heartbeat. As long as your fixed expenses are low enough that you can manage during a crisis, then you can count yourself secure enough to go ahead and have some fun. So that was point number two. Can you downshift the fixed expenses? And point number three, which we will discuss in detail next week, is what is your emergency backup plan? This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.